topic for tonight is the victory of radical reform. The victory of radical reform. So, the old school of thought, which has been debunked, is that Reform Judaism came from Central Europe to the United States as an ideology which was intact and ready to be implemented. But as we've said over the past few weeks, it's not really true that people came from Germany or from broader Central Europe to the United States as part of a wave of immigration, and they were not especially educated, whether secularly or even Judaically, and had no ideology of reform. Rather, they were just immigrant Jews. And that Americanization is what led to the watering down of their religious commitments and the change in style of their Judaism. So the greatest evidence of this is the decade of the 1860s, when we find that at the beginning of the decade, there were only a limited number of synagogues in the United States that had implemented significant liturgical reforms. But by the end of the decade, nearly every synagogue had done so. Dramatic turnover in a span of 10 or maybe 15 years. So why did it happen at that time? Several factors. So the most important thing is the cessation of immigration. Not immigration. The absence of immigration. In 1854, America had a recession, and so immigration came not to a halt, but it declined considerably.
That was de facto, not the jury?
Forget about whether it was lawful or unlawful. The bottom line is there were fewer people coming to these shores. So whereas after the failed revolution of 1848, 1849, you had a substantial influx, in the latter half of the 1850s, there were not as many. And then between 1861 and 1865, you had almost none. Why? Because of the Civil War. War puts a halt to immigration. People are not going to go to a place where they're getting shot. So the general rule of thumb in assessing the vitality of the American Jewish community is that if you have recent arrivals coming from places where Judaism was strong, it will invigorate or reinvigorate a declining religious community in a free, emancipated land where Judaism is not all that important and on the decline. So as long as you have fresh blood, fresh Jews that are pious or at least have elements of piety still intact, you're going to invigorate American Judaism. If you don't have that, you just have those who are already here, well, there's a slow diminution of the religious commitments. So American Jews are not encountering landsmen from across the way, from across the ocean. It's just the Americans. Now, they've only been here a little while. They're still somewhat greenhorns, but they're on the way to acculturation, to adapting to this environment. Also, the war. People are drafted. They fight, both for the Confederacy and for the Union, although primarily for the Union. And when you fight, so the linguistic barriers are overcome more rapidly than if you're part of an ethnic economy. If you're in an ethnic enclave in some eastern seaboard city, you can afford to speak German or whatever other language you might have been speaking for a little while longer. But if you're in an army, you have to listen to the orders of the officer and you have to follow instructions and learn the language. Also, you develop a measure of patriotism that you might not have had if you were just living the life of a peddler or the life of a merchant or a shopkeeper in the immigrant enclave. Also, economic prosperity. People were striking it rich. Now, not everyone struck it rich, but plenty of people elevated themselves beyond that of the impoverished classes to that of reasonably well-to-do middle class. And when you are wealthier, then your attachments to the old world decline, and attachment to religion might decline. Also, after in the 1860s, especially after the war, it was a time of progress in American religion more generally, not just Judaism. And it was seen as though the enlightened denominations are the wave of the future, and the old world denominations are for the dustbin of history. That's good for the reformers. And last but not least, because there is economic prosperity and the building up of new communities, there's the opportunity for the building of synagogues. And whenever you have a new edifice that is constructed, you have to ask serious questions about what we're going to do in that edifice. How are we going to conduct our services? So changes that might not have happened if the existing synagogue was still going to be in use, now all of a sudden come to the fore. Shall we put an organ? Shall we have mixed, create a balcony for the women? What is going to be the physical setup? Where is the bima going to be located? These questions are going to be answered in a non-traditional fashion. So all these factors lead to the rapid rapid advance of liturgical and ritual reforms in American Judaism. One of the things that also... Yeah?
Is there a correlation that the people that enjoy prosperity most quickly were the ones that were the least devout?
Yes. Yes, yes, absolutely.
So it becomes self-fulfilling. So if they're the ones with the money, and they're the ones thinking of...
They're the ones with the money, and they're the ones who make the decisions about how to allocate communal resources, right, since they're writing the check. Okay.
Did that same pattern occur after World War I and World War II? Or
after World War One, you do have... the same sort of thing, where because you don't have the heavy influx of immigrants because of the Johnson Reed Act, the immigration restrictions, so the community is a rapidly Americanized community. After World War II, maybe the opposite holds true, because you have people who are Holocaust survivors, refugees from the DP camps, who are reinvigorating traditional Judaism in a country where it was thought to be gone. That's true. That's true. And we'll get to that in about 2 months from now at length. Okay. So, another thing that happens with prosperity and with the arrival of real Reform Judaism, there is the desire for impressive ecclesiastical leadership. Something that they did not desire one or two or three decades earlier. Remember I said that people didn't listen to the first rabbis who showed up. They had not so illustrious careers. They had a lot of trouble, difficulty developing constituency. But those who were brought on the scene in the mid to late 1860s were people already with a reputation. These were not fly-by-night pseudo-rabbis who created a reputation for themselves in America. They were people who already were prestigious. The likes of Samuel Hirsch, Samuel Adler, Marcus Jastrow, Benjamin Zold, so Kaufman Kohler.
Why would they come here if they were illustrious?
Okay, so in some cases, they couldn't get work in Germany, at least in one particular case, that of Kaufman Kohler, because he wrote a doctoral dissertation in which he accepted some of the more extreme postulates of biblical criticism, so that in Germany, even in the liberal communities of Germany, he was too much of an ideological radical to get a job. His father-in-law, David Einhorn, was the same situation. He was in Budapest briefly until the government shut him down, and then he came to America in 1855 because he couldn't get work in Europe. So there were reasons why people moved. Either there was a job waiting for them that was going to pay a lot of money, or they had to escape the consequences of their own ideology in Europe. All right. Since we mentioned the Civil War, just a few little highlights of the relationship of the rabbis to the Civil War. On January 4th, 1861, President Buchanan issued a national day of fasting and prayer in the hopes that there would be some spiritual solution to the crisis of the Union that is being dissolved. Buchanan was not exactly the best president in U.S. history. He's considered one of the worst, and with good reason. But with little else to go on, he turned to God and to religion. Let's save our Union, solve our problems with the teshuva, tefillah, tzedakah. And there was some interest in what the Jewish clergy had to say about the matter of slavery, because after all, America is a land that loves the Bible. Unlike Catholic Europe, where they hate the Bible and they're suspicious of the Bible, Protestant America has an affinity for the Old Testament. And who knows the Old Testament better than the Jews? After all, it's their Bible. So let's turn to the rabbis and see what they say. And the two biggest players on the scene were Morris Raphael and David Einhorn. Morris Raphael was the rabbi of B'nai Jeshurun, a very well-paid in my opinion, overpaid rabbi. He was like the Albert Pujols of the 1860s rabbinate. He was like way overpaid. And he, as a northerner, relied upon scripture, in particular the Ten Commandments, to justify slavery, chattel slavery in the American South. Now, where in the Ten Commandments does it mention anything about slaves? The fourth commandment, Shabbos. What must your slave do?
Rest.
So the fact that your slave must rest means that slavery is a legitimate institution in the world. He could have quoted Ki Tikne Eved Ivri or whatever, Parshas Mishpatim. He happened to quote the Ten Commandments because he knew that the your average Gentile in America knows the Ten Commandments, if not by heart, then at least can respect a reading of it. And that's his viewpoint. So here a New York rabbi or a clergyman, a Jewish clergyman, is advocating in favor of the retention of slavery as an institution in America. Is that going to get him in trouble? Well, not really. I'll tell you why. Because even though New York is a northern city, it wasn't such a northern city. I mean, there were draft riots in 1863. It's not as though New York was chock full of radical abolitionists who wanted to do away with chattel slavery in the South. You could have...
Truth be told, the mayor and the political establishment of the city of New York, which was then Manhattan and the Bronx,
They were
Democrats and the Democratic Platform Committee.
So, Rafael got away with what he had to say, even though he was in the North. David Einhorn heard about this and was aghast. David Einhorn, the radical reform ideologue, who's the rabbi at Har Sinai in Baltimore, says, no, the Judaism doesn't support slavery. And as for the fact that the Bible mentions slavery, well, he believes in progressive revelation, not just the Sinaitic revelation as a one-time thing, that whatever's in the Sinaitic revelation is God's law forever, but rather that God's law evolves over time based upon what we conceive it to be. And so, as humanity becomes less barbaric and more enlightened, we should come to realize that God is against slavery. And so, certainly American slavery in the South violates every moral principle and should be abolished. Well, Baltimore, being a good Southern city, and the Jews wanting to fit in and not be seen as outcasts in society, cannot have their clergymen espousing a view which is contrary to the popular will in this locale. And so they told their rabbi, shut up. In simple words, don't talk about politics. So Einhorn's response was, is there anything more religious than the matter of human dignity and slavery? It's not a political topic, it's a religious topic. Is he right? Well, maybe. I mean, the international border between politics and religion is not a very fine one that you can pinpoint. It's a very vague and amorphous one. But he was in trouble, and he was run out of town. There was a threat. He was threatened with being lynched, and so in the middle of the night, he ran away and left Har Sinai of Baltimore and became the rabbi of Knesset Israel in Philadelphia, where he would go on to, for the next 5 years, espouse radical reform in a comfortable, environment in a northern city. All right. Isaac Meir Wise is the other leading figure in the American rabbinate at that time. But as I've said about Isaac Meir Wise before, he's a real phony. And his viewpoint, his personal, sincere viewpoint, doesn't matter. He may not have even had one. He goes where the wind is blowing. He's living in Cincinnati, which is near the Mason-Dixon line, and has a constituency from his newspaper and his broader following that is all over the West and the South. So for him to be a Republican abolitionist would be bad for business, very bad for business. And so instead, he's a border state Democrat whose position is, let's not fight a war. I'm not necessarily in favor of slavery, but I'm not going to do anything to abolish slavery. It's a comfortable middle ground position of a guy with no scruples. Okay? But it wins. It's a winning position because during the war you could say, I'm not in favor of bloodshed, and after the war you could say, I was in favor of the good guys winning. All right. Now, back to the issue of denominational struggle. Although many of the synagogues were moving in the direction of heavy reform, some synagogues wanted to arrest that progress, or at least slow down that progress. And the two most famous examples are Ohev Shalom, the Rodev Shalom. Okay? Ohev Shalom in Baltimore, Benjamin Zold's congregation, the father of Henrietta Zold, and Rodev Shalom in Philadelphia, the shul of Marcus Jastrow. They both came to America around 18—Zold came in 1860, and Jastrow came in 1866. Yes, the famous Talmudic dictionary came out in 1903. It's still used to this day in yeshivas who don't know who Jastrow was, that he was basically a moderate reform rabbi. If they knew, they wouldn't use it.
I got it from our Mr. President.
Yeah.
Are you certain of that appellation? My impression was that Jastrow and Zold were basically, by normal circumstances, the forerunners of real conservatism.
So yes, they are the forerunners of conservative Judaism. I will say that, yes, they are the forerunners, but in the moment, there is no conservative movement, and so therefore there is a left and a right of reform movement, and they are the right of the reform movement. In what regard? So Zold was very much in favor of Shmiras Shabbos, which is a losing battle in the United States. It's not an easy thing to try to hold on to the Sabbath observance of your laity, your members who have economic opportunities that are only available to them if they open 7 days a week or 6 days a week, with the day off being Sunday. But he fights a good fight, yet liturgically he is willing to be a compromise individual, a man of compromise. He redacts the Siddur. He puts out his own volume called Avodat HaKodesh in the early 1860s. And he abolishes the second day of Yom Tov. And at some point he even abolishes the wearing of a yarmulke.
This is
Jastrow. This is Zold. And he puts the Haftorah in the vernacular. Jastrow allowed an organ and allowed revision of the liturgy. Then, when Jastrow was getting on in years, in 1892, the shul wanted him to retire. He was older. They wanted a fresh rabbi, a new young rabbi. They hired a fellow named Henry Berkowitz, who was a young, early graduate of Hebrew Union College. And Berkowitz wanted to have one day yontif, organ, radical liturgy, all the usual changes that we would expect of high reform. And Jastrow, in his last Shabbos, functioning as the rabbi of the shul, as they're transitioning to the new guy, gave a farewell speech in which he said that if a rabbi does not want to hold to the positions of classical Judaism, he shouldn't be in the rabbinate. Which was a good shtach to his successor, saying, you don't deserve the title of rabbi, you're a shegetz. But the congregation wanted to move in that direction, and so Rodev Shalom became just a generic reform synagogue. So we see that, yes, there were important figures who were forerunners of conservative movement, but they struggled, and usually failed, to protect their houses of worship from the onslaught of radical reform. Okay. By the way, if that's true then, what were the early conservative synagogues? They were not synagogues founded by the German wave of Jews. They were modern synagogues founded primarily by the next wave of Eastern Europeans who came early and were already Americanized by the 19-teens. And they formed the core of the United Synagogue of America when it was founded by Solomon Schuchter in 1913. Not the synagogues we're talking about now, which were from the earlier wave.
Was okay. There a big difference between East Coast synagogues and...
Yes, okay, so there was a rivalry between the East and the West. The Easterners were considered the radical ideologues, and the Westerners, likewise, were considered the pragmatic ones who wanted to make people happy and were willing to retain certain religious usages that were traditional, just because to eliminate them too soon would alienate people who still had pious sentiments from the past. So the West was more frum, and the East Coast was more radical, but you shouldn't think that the West Coast, that the Allegheny Jews and the Midwest was pious in any way. We'll see soon enough that that's just a holding pattern, waiting for sentiment to change even further in the direction of irreligion. Irreligion. Okay.
Yeah, so what draws anyone to Reform Judaism? As opposed to secular Judaism?
Okay, the answer to that is people who are drawn to Judaism because of sentimental attachments to the religion of their ancestors, they want religion. Well, what's available to them? If the only thing available is the American Judaism as espoused by Isaac Meir Wise and his henchmen, then that's what you have. So it's not that they're attracted to Reform Judaism. It's they're attracted to Judaism, and this is American Judaism.
What about today?
Today is a different story. We're in the 21st century. Religion is on the decline everywhere. And I don't know. I don't know what...
6 months from
now. Yeah. Yeah, 6 months from now. I don't know. I'm on the Westchester Board of Rabbis. And I deal with heterodox clergy once a month. And I'll be honest, I don't know what attracts people to Reform Judaism. I don't know. But you don't need a way out. This is America. You don't need religion.
How often does the average Reform Jew go to service?
I don't know. Okay.
Otherwise, it'd be a Unitarian. I mean, so.
Well, we're going to get to that very soon. The alternatives, the non-Judaic alternatives to spiritual life, will be in the 1870s. Ethical culture. Yeah.
How did they get away with the second day of Yom Tov?
That's a very easy thing to abolish. It's not in the Bible.
Everybody wants it.
Well, it's a change that people were in favor of, and it's not in the Bible, so it's very easy to pull off. Okay, now, all this said, we have to now turn to 1869. You have a conference in Philadelphia. This conference was called by Einhorn, and the leading player in it really was his son-in-law, Kaufman Kohler. Kohler was a Talmud of Samson Raphael Hirsch, so he had a traditional Orthodox rabbinic education, and then got his degree from the various German universities, wrote his dissertation on criticism of the Bible, and couldn't get a job in Europe. He comes to Detroit in 1869, is there for 2 years, then he's rabbi in Sinai congregation in Chicago, and then he comes to New York in 1879 to succeed his father-in-law, Einhorn, as the rabbi of Bethel, at which point in time the other son-in-law of Einhorn, Kohler's brother-in-law, Emil Hirsch, the son of Samuel Hirsch, becomes the rabbi in Chicago and is the most illustrious Reform rabbi in the Midwest for the next 50 years. Okay, so who was present in this meeting in 1869 in Philadelphia? Samuel Adler of New York, who was the rabbi of Emmanuel, Joshua Kronick of Chicago, David Einhorn of Bethel, New York, Bernard Felsenthal of Chicago, who was a radical ideologue, James Guttheim of New York, Samuel Hirsch of Philadelphia, who was the rabbi of Knesset Israel, who was the successor of Einhorn, Kohler of Detroit, Moses Milziner of New York, who later would go on to become professor of Talmud at Hebrew Union College, and a couple of other names who don't matter, and finally Isaac Meir Wise of Cincinnati. And they come up with a platform. A platform that had eluded the rabbis in Germany in the 1840s when they gathered three times, in 1844, 45, and 46. If you remember, there was discussion of producing a platform, but those who were ideologically or strategically opposed to the production of a platform won the day, and there never was one. So now, 69, you have one. A lot of these fellows who had participated in some of the earlier battles in the 1840s in Germany. Point number one. The messianic aim of Israel is not the restoration of the old Jewish state under a descendant of David, involving a second separation from the nations of the earth, but the union of all the children of God in the confession and unity of God, so as to realize the unity of all rational creatures and their call to moral sanctification. Okay, it's a lot of highfalutin language, but I want you to notice something very important. Unlike some of the earlier manifestations of Reform, where it was all negative, 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 we believe in nothing, we don't believe in this, we don't believe in that, the Philadelphia platform was very savvy. There's a denial of some traditional belief in every point, bullet point, but related to it is the affirmation of something else. So, there's the denial of the traditional Shivat Zion and Malchut Beit David, That's not going to happen. But what is there? There's an affirmation of Shechem Echad Le'avdecha, that we're all going to be brothers in Malchut Shakai, that we'll accept the sovereignty of God. So the expectation of the restoration of the Jewish polity in the Holy Land, no, but we are expecting a future time when our God, the God of Israel, who is the universal God, will be universally worshipped. Which is right out of the second paragraph of Aleinu. Okay. Point number two. We look upon the destruction of the second Jewish commonwealth not as punishment for the sinfulness of Israel, but as a result of the divine purpose revealed to Abraham, which has ever become clearer in the course of world's history, consisting in the dispersion of the Jews to all parts of the earth, for the realization of their high priestly mission to lead the nations to the true knowledge and worship of God. So, what's going on here? There's no Reshit Tzmichat Gulatenu going back to Eretz Yisrael from Medinat Yisrael. No belief in that. And a rejection of Mipnei Chataenu Galina Me'artzenu. We don't believe in that. The exile was not because of our sins, but rather it was a purpose. It was a plan by God for the Jewish people to bring monotheism around the world. Okay. Point number three. The Aaronic priesthood and the Mosaic sacrificial cult were preparatory steps to the real priesthood of the whole people, which began with the dispersion of the Jews, and to the sacrifices of sincere devotion and moral sanctification, which alone are pleasing and acceptable to God. These institutions, preparatory to higher religiosity, were consigned to the past, once and for all, with the destruction of the Second Temple, and only in this sense, as educational influences in the past, are they to be mentioned in our prayers. In other words, the Korbanot, in their own day, may have had value, but they were an earlier phase in the evolution of human religiosity, and so if we're going to remember them, we're only going to remember them as having been an earlier preparatory phase. So we don't have to deny the fact that there once were korbanot. We can recall them as having been an element of our religious past, but with a full awareness that it was only in the past, and not today, because we're better than that today. Okay. Number four. Every distinction between Aaronids and non-Aaronids, as far as religious rights and duties are concerned, is consequently inadmissible, both in the religious cult and in social life. So no more Kohanim, they play no role in our version of Judaism, but it's interesting that it says in religious cult and in social life. I understand religious cult means they don't duchen with the hands, they don't get the first aliyah, but what do you mean social life? Okay, so the marriage restrictions don't apply anymore. Or alternatively, you know, if you have a mezuzah and you want to give it to the Kohen, social life, you honor the Kohen. That's gone too. All right. Five. The selection of Israel as the people of religion, as the bearer of the highest idea of humanity, is still as ever to be strongly emphasized. And for this very reason, whenever this is mentioned, it should be done with full emphasis laid on the world-embracing mission of Israel and the love of God for all of His children. This is the most... This is the spin zone right here. There's a lot of dishonesty in this point. I'll read it again. The selection of Israel as the people of religion, as the bearer of the highest idea of humanity, is still, as ever, to be strongly emphasized. So what does that mean? Jewish chauvinism. We're the best. Okay? There's a certain chosenness to the Jewish people and to our faith. But then it continues, and for this very reason, whenever this is mentioned, it should be done with full emphasis laid on the world-embracing mission of Israel and love of God for all of His children. Well, what does A have to do with B? It doesn't have anything to do with B. This is the spokesperson spinning a story to make it sound better than it really is. If you're a Jewish chauvinist and believe in the elitism of our people, then you're not speaking about, you know, the world-embracing vision and everybody's wonderful and God loves everyone. God may love everyone. Okay, we all might be B'Tselem Elokim, but what does that have to do with the chosenness of Israel? Nothing. It's what. So why do they say it?
Politically correct.
Okay, fine. Or Lagoyim, granted, but it's a political correct issue. You can't, as much as these rabbis are radical reformers, some of them are still sincere believers in the superiority of Jews and Judaism. And so they might want to think that internally, but you can't say that too much in an open forum or in a public mixed venue. Therefore, in the mixed venue, what do you say? That God loves all of His children. God loves all... You know, sometimes you can't say what you really want to say. You have to have an alternative. But Baruch Hashem, Judaism has stray lines here and there that are universal in character and can make everybody happy. And you emphasize those points. All right, number six. The belief in the bodily resurrection has no religious foundation, and the doctrine of immortality refers to the after existence of the soul only. So they're rejecting Tchias HaMeisim, which, by the way, is to be expected, because the Gemara says that Minayin Tchias HaMeisim in a Torah, how do you know Tchias HaMeisim is from the Torah? And there are 13 different explanations. Why are there 13 explanations? Because none of them is compelling. That's the bottom line. Tchias HaMeisim in a Torah is something that Chazal sort of tried to force down the throats of rabbinic Jews, whether they liked it or not, whether it was compelling or not, and if you don't believe in it, you're considered a heretic. But is it all that compelling? Objectively not.
Where does it come from in the Torah? What was the basis?
We could go to the Gemara Sanhedrin and Perek Chelek and go through all the sources of another time, but they're not all that compelling. So here, a Reform Rabbi's convention, who are not bound by the doctrinal considerations of the Talmud, are free to say it has no religious foundation, but we do believe in an afterworld, but that afterworld is only of the soul. Number seven. Urgently as the cultivation of the Hebrew language.
Is that one of the explanations? It's only not allowable to be
explanation? Yes. Yes, it's an acceptable explanation. Yes. So, number seven. Urgently as the cultivation of the Hebrew language, in which the treasures of divine revelation were given, and the immortal remains of a literature that influences all civilized nations are preserved, must always be desired by us in fulfillment of sacred duty. That's a handful, which basically says, we need to know Hebrew. Our traditions are in Hebrew. Yet, it has become unintelligible to the vast majority of our co-religionists. Therefore, as advisable under existing circumstances, it must give way to prayer in intelligible language, which prayer, if not understood, is a soulless form. Meaning prayer in a language you don't understand, even if it's in Hebrew, is meaningless. Therefore, what must we do? We must daven in German or in English, whatever we understand. So, here you see the double talk, the spin of the Philadelphia Conference. It's always a rejection and an affirmation, or an affirmation and a rejection of the same principle. Hebrew is very, very important, but we're going to knock in the daven in Hebrew. So,
well, they're saying it's good for the scholars, but not good for the masses.
Well, it's saying that we need to preserve it, not just for the scholars, that people should be taught Hebrew, and maybe they will be taught Hebrew in the cheder, but when it comes to the shul, to the synagogue, where you need to know how you're communing with God, it must be in a language you truly understand, and not one for which you have very limited comprehension. Okay.
Is this during the time of Eliezer ben Yehuda?
No, before Eliezer ben Yehuda. Eliezer ben Yehuda is a kid in Russia at this point. Okay, so, yeah.
Is this about theology, or is this about trying to create Judaism that will be somewhat popular in this
thing? Okay, I'm glad you asked that. The answer is theology. Isaac Meir Wise did not call this conference. He showed up a day late and was not the president of this convention, this conference, but rather it was Samuel Hirsch, who was the hosting rabbi, the rabbi of Knesset Israel Philly. And the main players were the scholarly ideologues. That means Hirsch, that means Adler, and Einhorn, and most importantly Kohler, the young upstart. Wise is the practical fellow who wants to build up American Judaism and make it popular, or make his version of American Judaism popular. The European imported ideologues want to establish what is the meaning of Reform Judaism in abstract terms. And that's what dominates and animates this convention. And so Wise is there, but it's not to his liking. He signs off on it, but afterwards he'll lambast it as being Einhornian in nature. It wasn't my style. It wasn't what I wanted. He's always looking to attack the other guy.
Were the parties here considered as antagonistic among each other as the three conferences in Europe?
So the three conferences in Europe of the three, the one that had the most vitriol was the second one, the one at Frankfurt, where Zacharia Frankel got up and caused a lot of ruckus and walked out and established himself as a middle-of-the-road party, as a positive historical Judaism. Here, I don't think in the moment there was that kind of acrimony, but after the fact, there sure was a lot of mudslinging. Okay.
When you're dealing with a different constituency in America than in Europe. Yeah. In many, many ways, geographic, ethnic, you know, they were established, they were rooted, where in America, everybody was in
chaos. Office.
Chaos, you know.
Yeah, sure.
And it was a swirl,
you know. Okay, so very important point to be stressed here. They didn't merely discuss doctrine. They also discussed policy on certain religious issues. And one of them had to do with who is a Jew. So it was determined that the male child of a Jewish mother is no less than her female child, in accordance with the never-disputed principle of Judaism, to be considered a Jew by descent, even if he be uncircumcised. Now, halachically, that's true. That is true. But if you remember, back in the 1840s in Germany, there were serious debates about whether you should register that child as a Jew in the communal Rolodex, because if you refuse to, maybe that's a pressure, it's an incentive for them to co-opt, to capitulate and circumcise the kid. In America, where that's a complete non-factor, so what are they saying? The kid is a Jew, even if there's no bris. So, Isaac Mayer Wise...
What, can he get an aliyah?
They weren't giving an aliyah. Yeah. Halachically, in a real shul... It's a big question.
It's
a big question. Well, let's say we know. Let's say he announces, "I'm an Oril."
It's medical reasons.
So medical reasons, of course, he can have an aliyah. He can't eat the korban Pesach, but he can get an aliyah. All right. So Isaac Mayer Wise tries to throw a curveball here, and he says, "Well, now that we're in the business of downplaying the significance of bris milah, he proposes that proselytism, conversion of a male Gentile to Judaism, should be recognized even in the absence of circumcision." Whoa! That's a big one. To say that a goy is a Jew even without a bris. There's a certain consistency here if we're going to downplay bris milah, but the other fellas didn't go along for it. And David Einhorn was adamantly opposed to that suggestion. Why?
He was a male.
No. So the answer is because Einhorn was, despite being practically and ritually much less observant and ideologically opposed to observance than some of the other fellows at this meeting, at heart he was a real believer, a believer in God, a believer in the covenant, a believer in revelation, evolving revelation, but revelation nonetheless, and a belief in the elite status of the Jews. That we have a mission
more than everybody else.
That we have a mission. That we have a mission in the world to spread religious enlightenment. And because we have that mission, and we are a stam, the German word, S-T-A-M-M, that we are an ethnic stock. We're a group, a biological group in the world, and we have to maintain ourselves. So we're not just a bunch of co-religionists, but we're something of an ethnic group. Not a national group, remember, he's against Shivat Zion and all that stuff, but an ethnic group with a special religious mission. So how do we preserve that? Well, one way is to do mitzvahs, but he's against that. So the other way is no intermarriage. He was firmly against intermarriage. So you could eat pork on Yom Kippur, maybe, but no intermarriage. Why? Because we have an obligation to preserve ourselves as a distinct group for God in the world. All right?
So I can say I'm Jewish, no more.
No. So for Einhorn, all right, because the Jews have to maintain themselves separately, he said intermarriage is the nail in the coffin of Judaism. Right. He was ahead of his time on that. But he also said that we don't need gerim. He was opposed to gerim. We are the Jews, and everyone else are not the Jews.
So
So he doesn't want to reduce the barriers to entry into Judaism. What is the greatest barrier to entry into Judaism? Bris Mila. So Isaac Meir Wise wants American Judaism to be his style of Reform Judaism, and he has delusions of grandeur that one day the main religion in America, even for the Gentiles, will be Reform Judaism. That's like a universal church, universal Jewish church. That's his idea. Whereas Einhorn says, no, who cares about everybody else? We're a small little elite group, and we don't want outsiders, so don't get rid of bris, and don't intermarry. But you also don't have to keep mitzvahs. It's a very odd combination of priorities. Yeah.
But that style never perpetuates.
No, it can't. Of course it can't, because why would people limit their social opportunities, their matrimonial opportunities, to a small ethnic group of people who are curiously attached and unattached to their own religious heritage? And that's the problem with radical reform. Yeah.
Yeah. Today
yeah.
Or yesterday.
Yeah.
In Iceland.
Yeah.
They outlawed circumcision.
Circumcision.
And you know who agreed with them?
Who?
Iran.
Duh.
Okay.
Why
so.
Iceland, were they,
I don't know. I don't know. Beats
that,
me.
That today is a factor with circumcision.
Yeah.
Because it is medically.
I think every 20 years they reverse their opinion in the medical about whether it's good or bad.
Yeah,
it's true. Okay, so back to 1869 in Philadelphia, there were other issues discussed at that convention relating to marriage laws. One of them had to do with the wedding. What is the traditional betrothal formula? What's the wording? Kedat Moshe v'Yisrael. Kedat Moshe v'Yisrael. According to the law of Moses and Israel. So the reformers in Philadelphia didn't like that. We have to change that. Einhorn was opposed to the law of Moses and Israel because the law of Moses allows for polygamy and is not a true marriage of equal partners. It's the sense that the woman is tied to the man, but the man is not tied to the woman.
Can you say Moshe
v'Yisrael? So... No. All right. Okay, that's true.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, but so here instead he wanted to have according to the traditions of Israel and the law of God. Now, what's the law of God? For Einhorn, remember, who believes in progressive revelation, the law of God is whatever he thinks it is, because if civilization evolves and we have a higher a new moral standard, where did we get that moral standard from? God teaches, reveals it to us in whatever way. So the custom of Israel and the law of God. But Samuel Hirsch, the other ideologue, said, you know what, the notion of law in Reform Judaism is anathema, so we can't use that expression, law of God. So you have to have just traditions of Israel. I forget the exact wording, but there was no reference to Moses, and there was no reference to law. It was God and tradition, but not law. These are some of the issues that are troubling them when it comes to marriage. What about divorce? So the main...
marriage, concept of kinya, of giving a ring...
They wanted double rings. They wanted to make sure that the woman was equally a part of the ceremony as the man.
So that she wasn't in kinya.
Right, correct. So when it comes to divorce... The consensus was that you no longer need a get, that civil divorce is sufficient. However, of the 13 rabbis in the room, two of them said, oh no, we should maintain the notion of the get, at least in revised form. Those two were the Mesadra Gittin. So you ask, was he a Moel? So sometimes professional engagement does change your position, does influence your position on things. All right. The conclusion was you don't need a get. Now, the other issue was about the divorce. What do we do with the aguna? So they came to the conclusion that the evidence by which the state determines that someone is dead is acceptable in the eyes of religion in determining that the person is dead. So if there's a death certificate because there was circumstantial evidence that the guy's no longer alive, then the rabbis will accept it too. We don't need to have evidence to the standard required by the Talmud or the halakhic literature. That's an important point.
Let's say that people get married, there is no get.
Yeah.
Go and find somebody else.
Yeah. All right, so that does exist in the Reform world today. And they'll tell you, go to a conservative rabbi, he'll do a get for you. I've had situations like this, where people who are not involved in Orthodox life at all, they have a Reform affiliation, but there's a father or a grandfather in the picture who says, you have to have a get, and they'll turn, so the Reform rabbi will say, you know, go up the ladder a step or two, and they'll satisfy your wishes. Okay, so another very important point was the grounds for divorce.
You've got to find the former husband to give the get.
Oh, of course, yeah. So what about grounds for divorce? The rabbis in Philadelphia in 1869 were not happy with the fact that many states in the Union, either no-fault divorce or limited-fault divorce was in vogue, and people were changing marital partners on a whim, for reasons that they as clergymen could not find acceptable. And so they decided that if the state allows for divorce for reasons that are considered flimsy in the eyes of the clergy, that the clergyman has a right to refuse to officiate at a remarriage on the grounds that the first marriage was not properly dissolved. Now that is a tough one because, well, what it does is, it means that, what is Judaism? Judaism is the whim of the rabbis.
Exactly.
It says that there really are no rules, but what I feel is appropriate, my whim, is now the law that I'm imposing upon you.
Yeah. Basically, yeah. Their religion is saying,
yeah.
They're dissolving religion to such an extent, uh-huh. Many people don't even care that they have
Plenty of people still do care, and if they care, that's the hold the rabbis have over them. It's the extent to which people want religion in their life is the extent to which the clergyman in a Western country has control over you. I mean, that's all there is, which is not a theocracy, but if you care, then it means the rabbi has the measure of say over things. All right. Another, actually, forget. All right, so let's move on. After this conference, Wise had ideas up his sleeve of a congregational union. He wanted all the shuls in America to get together in a congregational union, of course, under his leadership. And so in 1871, there was a gathering in Cincinnati in which they determined that if we can get 20 synagogues with at least a membership of 2,000 people total, then we will form a union. And over the next year or two, he was moving in that direction, with a big following in the West, Midwest, and the South, but little or nothing in the East and the Northeast. In 1873, the Union of American Hebrew Congregations was established in Cincinnati. Actually, Wise did not play the leading role. It was a layperson, Dr. Martz Loth, who was the major instigator in this gathering. But the Union of American Hebrew Congregations fell under the influence of Wise, but Wise was wise, okay? He was a smart guy. He made sure that this union of congregations was not denominationally identifiable, because if it was, then it means you're going to alienate those people who disagree with you on doctrinal points. If you just say it's a union of American Hebrew congregations, well, any Jewish house of worship can fall into that category. From the holiest of the holy rollers of the Orthodox to the most radical of Reform. Will it be easy to bring them all into one group? No. But at least if you don't identify with a denomination, you could try and see how far you get. That's the chachma, the wisdom of the whole thing. So it's very successful. It starts off with 34 congregations. 2 years later, they have 55 congregations. A decade after that, they have over 100 congregations. So he's very, very successful in bringing everyone into the union.
These are all Reform?
No, they're not. Now, there were some that were what we might call forerunners of conservative Judaism. There may have even been some that you might say were at the time even Orthodox houses of worship, moderate Orthodox houses of worship. But that would not hold. Ultimately, the synagogues that would have a problem with head uncovered during worship, or would have a problem with the almost entirely English liturgy, they're going to have to abandon ship and say, this is not for us. So you have congregations that drop out in the 1880s, and other congregations that really wouldn't have fit in long term, but those congregations evolved and became more Reform. So they were closer to what Wise had in mind for American Judaism.
Why wasn't it for them? Was it doctrinal?
So the advantages are of joining. They were not necessarily practical advantages, but there was this sense that among Jews all over the country that it is in our collective best interest to have a strong and viable national Jewish organization. That the collective interest of American Jewry would be better represented if we have this body functioning. There was B'nai B'rith, which was a fraternal order, and there was also the Board of Delegates of American Israelites. Now, the Board of Delegates was founded in 1859 in response to the Edgardo Mortara affair, where the kid was kidnapped in Italy and taken into to create a Catholic family, became a priest. Okay, so the Mortara affair galvanized Jews in all over the world, including America. And so this Board of Delegates was like the elite, the cream of the crop of the Eastern congregations, who would petition the government to have the State Department do things in favor of Jewish interests abroad. So in the rift between East and West, this rivalry, the Board of Delegates was the Temple Emanuel crowd, or the Har Sinai crowd of Baltimore, whereas the Union of American Hebrew Congregations was Isaac Meir Wise and the Cincinnati group. Who wins in that battle? Cincinnati wins. And the Board of Delegates becomes just a committee within the broader Union of American Hebrew Congregations, the political propaganda arm based out of New York and then later out of Washington. Okay, yeah.
What was the charter of the Federation?
The charter, I mean, I couldn't tell you the exact verbiage, but it didn't speak much about religious issues. It was just to gather together American synagogues. Okay.
Political reasons.
There are political reasons in the sense that the Jews do need to worry about protecting Jewish interests in this country. I mean, General Order Number 11 in the Civil War was a problem, and the Jews were able to petition President Lincoln and get it resolved. There were issues in terms of the economic treaties with Switzerland, how they had rules against, you know, if you were not a Christian, and what if you were an American citizen going to Switzerland, or there were issues with the trade agreement with Russia. I mean, there are political issues that Jews have to worry about in the United States, and the Board of Delegates, and later the American Jewish Committee will address these issues, but between 1873 and the early 1900s, the Union of American Hebrew Congregations is the strongest body in American Judaism. Okay, but their main purpose was to establish a rabbinical seminary. A rabbinical seminary. Oh, we need to train our own rabbis. Because we can't keep relying upon guys coming over from Europe. Why not? What's wrong with relying upon people from Europe?
They're not ideologically in sync with the radicalism here in America.
Okay, so a few reasons. One, there's a linguistic barrier. They want German, and we speak English. Number two, Their religious point of view may not be exactly in line with ours. We're practically more radical than they are, although ideologically they may be more radical more than the Americans were. But also, there is the sense that the future of Jewish life is America. Europe is not the future. America is the future. And so we cannot rely upon the old world to supply our religious needs, whatever those needs might be. And a clergyman is one of the big needs. So we have to be able to do it ourselves.
You know, at that time, there were many more European Jews than American Jews.
The feeling was that America is the land of opportunity and that Europe is in the Dark Ages.
You must have had over 10 million Jews in Europe.
Doesn't matter. American Jews are full of themselves. Isaac Meir Wise is full of himself. And they regard... they have an American-centric view of the world. All right? Still do, absolutely. So You have to produce your own rabbis. Well, where's the seminary going to be? Cincinnati, of course, because Wise has to be in charge. So in 1875, Hebrew Union College is established. At the beginning, there were only about 17 students. Most of them were teenagers going to high school, and later would go to McMicken University in Cincinnati for an 8-year course of study to graduate college and the rabbinical school simultaneously. And they were coming from poor families. Who's going to become a rabbi? The son of poor people. And most of the kids who went were totally indigent and had to be given stipends to live because they couldn't afford room and board or tuition. Wise was very disappointed by the fact that the crop of students was coming from low-ranking elements of the community. But then again, he knew this was going to be the case because he tried it 20 years earlier with the Zion College in the 1850s, and the same thing happened. If you're anywhere successful in this country, you don't want your kid going to the clergy. You want your kid going to business. Business. The business of America is business, not religion. So that's his problem, attracting students. He also has another problem, attracting a faculty. Who's going to teach these kids? Who in America is competent to teach in rabbinical school?
Orthodox rabbis.
Ah, so that's going to be a very big issue that we're going to spend a lot of time on over the next few months. The fate of rabbinical seminaries in America, non-Orthodox rabbinical seminaries in America, who is on their faculty, and typically, especially in Talmud and Halacha, Orthodox rabbis, or people of Orthodox background whose then Orthodoxy may be in question, but certainly they are not in sync with the doctrines of the school. The classic example being Saul Lieberman. Well, Heschel, but Lieberman is the classic example. All right.
Why do they need to learn Halacha? Yeah, I was just going to say that.
Okay, so what are you going to teach? What are you going to teach them in the Reform Rabbinical School?
When I mention Heschel, I don't mean him being at JTS. Uh-huh. I mean him being at HUC.
Correct. Yeah. He was there for 5 years. Yeah.
He ran out.
Because they beat him up. They used to beat him up in the dormitory. They physically beat him up, yeah. All right. Heschel, he was a bachelor. He was like a nerdy guy who was bossed around and beaten up by the kids at HUC in the early 40s. All right, so who's going to teach in these places? In the beginning, you have almost nobody. Wise is a volunteer lecturer, but he's not a scholar by any stretch. He's a phony. I mean, he doesn't really know anything. Moses Mealziner of New York was hired to teach Talmud. He was, all right, a decent professor of Talmud for a crop of students who had never studied Talmud before. But it wouldn't be until 20 years after, or 30 years after the school was established, that you'd finally get serious professors of the Wissenschaft des Judentum, of the scientific study of Judaism, to teach. But in the beginning, interestingly, Wise didn't want Wissenschaft. He didn't want a real modern seminary. Because Wissenschaft was anathema to the Orthodox, who were suspicious that that's a way of teaching people heresy, apikorsis. So what did he want his school to teach? Basically, it was a glorified cheder that was going to teach Bible and Talmud, Mishnah, commentaries, at a low level, very low level, but without criticism, just the way it is. So, like you'd get in 6th grade Chumash class or 7th grade Gemara class in a day school, that's what HUC was, without a reformist bent to the learning itself, because they're not ready for that yet. And he wants the Orthodox or the middle of the roaders to think that this could be an institution for them as well. So he does something very smart. He invites people, traditional rabbis, to come to Cincinnati to serve on the board of examiners. Then in 1877, 79, 81, 83, they come every few years to give a faher, a bechina, a test, oral examination to the students to see how well they know their Bible, their Mishnah, their Talmud. And the rabbis come away impressed. Oh, these kids who should really know nothing because they're from Kentucky, from Iowa. Who knows? They're from the Yehovitzville, Jewishly speaking, and yet they know how to read Rashi. They can read a half a page of Talmud, maybe. It's very impressive. Now, it's not impressive compared to the yeshivas of Europe. Not at all. It's not even impressive compared to Hafter, but class of 99. But it does. Make an impression upon these traditional rabbis, who then in 1883 are ready to be invited to the first ever graduating class. David Phillips and the valedictorian, the author of the history of the reform movement. So you have four guys graduating in 1883, and the graduation was on July 11th, my birthday, 98 years before I was born. And what happens at this graduation? They serve trafe. So the trafe banquet goes down in history as being this momentous occasion. It was really the high point, the high watermark of 19th century Reform Judaism.
It's kind of crazy. You think they want to alienate the Orthodox, and he wants to make sure that Ched and everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And they've actually class. I mean,
right. So it was an accident. Yesh Omrim, there are those who say it was an accident. That what happened was, the Reform Jews of the Midwest didn't keep kosher, but they didn't eat pork. The one dietary law they adhered to was no pork. And there was no pork at the trefa banquet. There was mixture of meat and milk, there was oysters, various other trefa items, but there was no pork. The caterer figured that this is a Jewish gathering, we'll follow the standard protocol for Jewish gatherings here in Cincinnati, which means you can serve anything but no pork. The problem was that in this gathering were people of a more traditional bent who were coming from out of town, and they were offended. So in the mythology of American Judaism, the great mythology of American Judaism, they say that the trefa banquet led to the founding of the Jewish Theological Seminary, that the middle of the roaders who were totally appalled with the serving of trefa at the graduation of HUC decided we need to have a different institution, a competitor institution that will be for the good guys, and will establish the Jewish Theological Seminary of New York as an alternative to HUC of Cincinnati. Next week we'll discuss how it's not so simple. There's a lot of space between 1883 and 1886. A lot of stuff happens in that crucial period of 3 years, the ideological ferment. But suffice it to say that the trefa banquet was Isaac Meir Wise's way of saying that Judaism is what we want it to be. We're not beholden to the laws of the past, and if you have a problem with what we served, well then you're just an old, you're an old style Jew who is committed to stomach Judaism, kitchen Judaism, gastric Judaism. Those were the terms he used. Was he really so antagonistic to the kosher observer? No. But like Donald Trump, when he's backed into a corner, he punches back. And so the kitchen Judaism, stomach Judaism, it's not that he really intended to be so hostile, but under the circumstances, he had to fight back, and that was his reaction. Okay, we'll stop here. Next time, we'll do the Pittsburgh platform.